KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, where we have overcast skies, 55 degrees. We're looking for more rain today, high near 56, southeast wind to 10. Rain tonight too, mainly before 7 p.m., low of 51 overnight, east winds to 20, will turn to the west after midnight and could gust as high as 40 miles per hour tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, we have our new update from the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center. A Kodiak fisherman was sentenced to time in prison and a hefty fine. And Senator Murkowski gets money for ferries in the infrastructure bill. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In New York, state lawmakers are preparing to hold a series of public hearings this month ahead of a potential impeachment vote against Governor Andrew Cuomo. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports lawmakers met today almost a week after a New York State Attorney General's investigation concluded that Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has denied touching anyone inappropriately, and the chair of the New York State Assembly's Judiciary Committee, Democrat Charles Levine, says Cuomo will have a chance to provide lawmakers with information before they decide whether to hold a vote on his impeachment. Levine says in addition to the allegations of sexual harassment, lawmakers have also been looking into whether Cuomo used public resources to write a book and gave special access to coronavirus testing to his relatives, as well as Cuomo's administration underreporting the number of nursing home patients in the state who have died from COVID-19. Anzi Luong, NPR News, New York.
More students are heading back to in-person learning in widely varying approaches to COVID-19 safety. The head of one of the nation's largest teachers' unions has changed her mind about vaccine mandates. NPR's Claire Lombardo reports that Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, now says she backs required vaccinations for educators.
Weingarten told NBC's Meet the Press her stance is now a matter of personal conscience.
I think that we need to be working with our employers, not opposing them, on vaccine mandates and so, you know, and all their vaccine policies.
She added that this week, AFT leaders will be revisiting last year's policy, which said mandates should be negotiated at a local level. Separately, the executive director of the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union, tells NPR it's looking at the question of a mandate right now. Most teachers are vaccinated anyway, according to White House data. As of now, fewer than a third of 12 to 15-year-olds are fully vaccinated, and kids under 12 aren't eligible. Claire Lombardo, NPR News.
The head of the UN is describing the most comprehensive intergovernmental report on climate change released today as a code red for humanity. It says that unless there are immediate and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, limiting warming to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit will be beyond reach. The report's co-author, Kim Cobb, lays out the kind of extreme weather the U.S. and its neighbors are likely to encounter in the coming decades.
Here in North America, the report makes clear that we are facing a combination of worsening impacts on land and in the ocean and along our coasts, including a significant increase in the frequency and intensity of weather and climate extremes.
Today's report being released against the backdrop of destructive weather conditions happening earlier than usual and with greater intensity around the globe. The Biden administration says that's evident in the massive wildfires that have erupted across the West, the most prominent, the nearly 500,000-acre Dixie Fire, the second largest in California history. This is NPR News.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
Kodiak is experiencing an outbreak of COVID-19, that according to the new release from the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center. 16 new cases have been reported for the Kodiak Island Borough. 13 cases were tested on the 6th. Of these, 8 are considered community spread, 4 are close contacts, and 1 is travel-related. 1 was tested on the 7th, that was a close contact case, and 2 were tested on the 9th. 1 was travel-related, 1 was close contact. That makes a total of 107 cases currently classified active locally. The total case count is now 1,330. There have been 58 local hospitalizations to date, and there are 3 active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. On Friday, a U.S. District Court judge sentenced commercial fisherman James Aaron Stevens of Kodiak to 6 months in federal prison and a $1 million fine for falsely labeling fish in violation of the Lacey Act. Stevens pleaded guilty to the charges in November of 2020 after investigation by NOAA's Office of Law Enforcement. Stevens owned and operated the FV Alaskan Star and the FV Southern Seas. He admitted in a plea agreement that he lied on the individual fishing quota landing reports and logbooks about where he harvested over 900,000 pounds of halibut and sable fish between 2014 and 2017. Stevens sold the falsely labeled fish, which had a market value of over $13 million, violating the Lacey Act. The Lacey Act, passed in 1990, is a federal law that makes it illegal to sell fish that were harvested in violation of U.S. law. Stevens' attorney had asked for a sentence of 1 year home confinement to be served intermittently so Stevens could still participate in commercial fishing openers, but that was denied. Many family members, friends, and fellow fishermen wrote letters in support of Stevens, pointing to his role as a father and husband with a strong and honest work ethic. Some letters asked for the fine to be reduced. A letter written by Janice Stevens, James's wife, pointed to instability and inequities in the halibut and sablefish IFQ program that put economic strains on fishermen. As part of his sentencing, Stevens must also create a public service announcement acknowledging his crime and serve 80 hours in community service. Last month, Kotzebue had its wettest month on record with more than 5 inches of total rainfall. As Northwest Alaska was showered with rain, a small group from Minnesota was canoeing on the Noatak River with a toddler in tow. KOTZ's Wesley Early caught up with the group as they wrapped up in Kotzebue, and he has this story.
The Noatak River runs for about 425 miles, winding from gates of the Arctic National Park through the Noatak National Preserve before emptying out into the Kotzebue Sound. Bear Paulson of Minnesota heard from friends that it'd be a beautiful canoe trip filled with gorgeous scenery and some nice hiking.
There's a lot of canoeists in Minnesota because of the boundary waters and what have you. And really what we've got is just a network of people that have paddled various rivers all throughout Canada and Alaska and what have you. And so we talked to friends of ours, and they said, oh, yeah, Noatak's a great river. You know, we have other friends that actually took a two-year-old down it.
With no portages and some nice white water, Paulson felt comfortable bringing along his son, Dashua, who's just under 3. Dashua's mother, Claire Porter, and friend Dan Cook rounded out the group, who arrived in Kotzebue on July 11th.
We had 12 days of sun. Felt like the desert. Absolutely gorgeous. You know, we put in as high up as we could. Lucky Six is the name of the area.
Lucky Sixth Creek is near the mouth of the Noatak, up by Ambler and Kobuk. Paulson and company spent most of the time taking in hikes as they slowly moved along the river. As they decided to pick up their pace along the Noatak, rain clouds above started to have the same idea.
A few days after we started to move along was when the rain started, and we've heard 250% of average rainfall, somewhere in that neighborhood.
It was the wettest month on record for Kotzebue.
We were deluged.
Paulson says adjusting to the rainfall meant monitoring the water level to make sure it didn't reach the group or their gear as they camped.
We were putting marks and cairns, you know, sticks in the shore, cairns on the shore to measure how far up the river was coming each night. making sure we wouldn't get sunk. And we were continuously wet.
Paulson says while he didn't expect the level of rainfall his group encountered, they had prepared for less than dry conditions.
It's something that you always are aware of that might happen. I mean, we didn't really expect, it was pretty surprising to get 10 straight days of rain. But we had, you know, we have nice tents, we have a nice bug shelter that keeps us out of the rain when we need to.
Paulson said they adjusted their approach slightly, considering they had Dashua with them. Paulson says he felt the Noatak was a mellow, more predictable river than others he'd paddled.
Beyond that, we don't paddle long days because otherwise he goes nuts. He starts hitting his mother because he shares the bow with her. He'll last about 3 hours at a stretch.
The rainfall made one last strong push at the end of July before the skies started to part and sunshine fell on the Northwest Arctic. For Paulson, it was the optimal time to power back to town.
We were about 20 miles up the Noatak and saying, okay, do we think we can cross today or tomorrow morning? You know, and you kept looking at the forecast, looking at the forecast, looking at the forecast, and was like, I'm pretty sure we can do it on. And so, yeah, total reprieve. I mean, to be able to paddle right to the hotel.
The expedition concluded last Thursday as Paulson and company pulled up to shore from the Kotzebue Sound right in front of the Nulugvik Hotel. Looking back, Paulson says his trip up the Noatak, his first in Alaska, was a little too wet, but the bugs weren't that bad, and he loved it. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Wesley Early.
Providence Health and Services Alaska says all of its employees must be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 by the end of September or follow additional rules. Providence is Alaska's largest hospital and largest private employer. It is among a growing number of healthcare organizations requiring staff to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Providence, Alaska Chief Medical Officer says it's a critical step as the highly contagious Delta variant spreads and nearly all of the hospital's COVID patients are unvaccinated.
The higher we have levels of vaccination in our workforce, in our caregivers, the better we will protect that workforce from acquiring infection, spreading it to other caregivers, or, you know, even potentially exposing patients.
Providence, Alaska employs roughly 5,000 people. Bernstein says the nearly 70% are vaccinated so far. If staff won't get vaccinated, they must sign a refusal form and comply with additional education and safety measures. Providence is also putting visitor restrictions back in place at its Anchorage Hospital, as well as here in Kodiak, because of high coronavirus case counts in the community. Alaskans' participation in a medical school program is threatened by an impasse over how to pay for it. And while lawmakers disagree over the program, students are worried that they will see large tuition increases. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Jesse Klaika was born and raised in Bethel, where his father is a doctor. He's one of 20 Alaskans who are accepted each year into a program that allows Alaska to support medical education without having to operate a medical school. The students graduate from the University of Washington School of Medicine. Klaika is in his second year of the program. He's been interested in it since he was 9 years old.
I was excited to hear about a program that puts special emphasis on training and retaining docs for Alaska with assistance for those students who are interested in going down the path of rural medicine.
He says it serves as a pipeline for doctors to serve in Bethel.
Our hospital works hard to recruit talented individuals, but for many who aren't from Alaska, it's hard for them to call it home. I've seen the same challenge exist across the state, with hospitals having to spend money on recruitment and travel docs to help fill shifts.
On Friday, he was told that barring a resolution to the legislature's budget dispute, his class will have to pay out-of-state tuition this year. While he doesn't know what that difference will be, last year the average difference was $30,000. In addition, recruitment for Alaska students for the class that would start next year has stopped for now. The program is known as WAMI. It's named after the first letters of the names of the five states that participate: Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. For many years, the legislature has voted to fund the program from an account that's separate from the rest of the state budget. But this year, the vote failed, and students could have to pay tens of thousands of dollars more for tuition. So students and others involved in healthcare in Alaska are asking lawmakers to agree to fund the program in the upcoming special session. They spoke at a recent meeting of the working group of legislators weighing changes to the state budget for the long term. Dr. Kristen Mitchell is a WAMI faculty member who lives in Kenai and works in Soldotna. She moved to the state because of the program. She told lawmakers that the state receives an impressive return on its investment because WAMI students tend to stay in the state.
Alaska has a primary care shortage, as I know you're aware, and we urgently need to train excellent Alaskan physicians to provide medical care to Alaskans.
She says the budget dispute is causing anxiety for students over how to pay for their education. And she said a similar dispute 2 years ago caused Alaska to lose future doctors.
I fielded untold calls from students and families who wondered if they should accept offers of admission from other schools rather than from the University of Alaska and WAMI, and we lost the opportunity to train some outstanding students over that funding uncertainty.
Catherine Mitchell grew up in North Pole and chose WAMI so she could stay in Alaska. She's not related to Kristen. She's concerned that the funding problem will mean the end of the program.
I ask you to think about your own experiences in healthcare and ask yourself what it would mean if you could have a doctor who's from your community, knows your environment, and the needs of your region.
Not everyone who testified supported the program. Some who support higher permanent fund dividends consider WAMI a special interest. Kerry Mullis of Delta Junction said the legislature's first priority should be putting the PFD in the state constitution and paying Alaskans the dividend amounts they would have received the last 5 years if the state followed the formula in a 1982 state law. Including this year's dividend, that adds up to more than $10,000.
The WAMI people shouldn't be calling in tonight. This is about people and their PFD. The WAMI people shouldn't even be allowed to talk tonight. And I just want you guys to do the right thing, which is to do the constitutional PFD and give us back our money.
Some Republican House members who voted against restocking the fund that would pay for the program say they still support it, but they want the funding to be paid along with the rest of the budget, not from a separate fund. Opponents of this proposal say it would require drawing more than planned from the permanent fund and that this would open the door to spending down the permanent fund in the future. Governor Mike Dunleavy hasn't put funding for WAMI and similar programs on the agenda for the special session, which means lawmakers won't be able to consider it. But he could add it to the agenda at any time before the session ends. The 30-day session is scheduled to start on August 16th. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The U.S. Senate is inching toward passage of a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. It's a top priority of Senator Lisa Murkowski, who helped negotiate it. The bill includes billions for Alaska's roads, bridges, and ferries, plus funds for broadband and water projects in rural communities. The bill has enough Republican votes to pass, but it's not clear how Senator Dan Sullivan will vote. He hasn't announced his position. In a procedural vote Saturday, Sullivan voted against advancing the legislation. His spokesman said he favored more debate and opportunities to amend it. But on late Sunday, in another procedural vote, Sullivan was among 18 Republicans who joined Democrats to support the bill. The Senate could pass the infrastructure package tomorrow and send it to the House. U.S. military service members in Alaska and worldwide will be required to get a COVID-19 vaccination beginning next month. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced this morning that he is ordering mandatory vaccinations in response to President Biden's request to add the vaccine to the list of those that service members are already required to get. Austin says he's asked the president to approve of his plan to implement the new policy by mid-September, or he says the policy will become effective immediately after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration fully approves licensure of one of the COVID vaccines that are now widely available, whichever comes first. Austin says in a news release issued this morning that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is likely to achieve full FDA licensure early next month. He He says the armed services will begin preparations for administering vaccines to personnel who haven't yet gotten the vaccine as soon as the president okays the plan or the FDA approves full licensure. Austin says he consulted with Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Army General Mark Milley over the past week on his vaccination mandate plan, as well as the armed services secretaries and medical professionals. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is so far not requiring students and staff to be vaccinated against COVID-19, but Chancellor Dan White says they are encouraged to go online and attest to their vaccination status.
My hope is that everyone takes advantage of our vaccination voluntary attestation opportunity online. And you can just go to uaf.edu and go to the click on the COVID information, and it will take you to the vaccine voluntary attestation.
White said a lot of students and staff have been registering their status, but that he did not have a percentage of those who say they are vaccinated. He added that if the university doesn't get the information voluntarily, it may require students and staff to attest to their vaccination status, emphasizing that the information is important to decision-making as the COVID-19 pandemic ramps back up just after the fall semester has begun.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Plastics from fishing gear get turned into lumber in Cordova. More on coast-to-coast efforts after this.
Grundin's Deck Boss 15-inch boots feature a protective toe cap, uppers that won't crack, and compression-molded rubber outsoles for better traction on wet decks. Made in USA.
Turning plastics from old fishing gear and marine debris into durable lumber is building momentum from coast to coast, and one Alaska entrepreneur plans to take it on the road. Patrick Simpson of Cordova received a $100,000 grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to develop a mobile plastic waste recycler. He told Alaska Public Media that the recycler would fit into one or two 40-foot container vans for easy transport to local communities.
The technology is not horribly difficult. It's been proven, and the innovation is the use of the net combined with the melted plastic to create an extruded recycled plastic lumber and the packaging into this mobile platform.
Along with old fishing gear, Simpson plans to focus on plastic waste materials that wash up on local coastlines. He hopes to gather the goods collected in community beach cleanups before it goes to the landfill. Plastic comes in many forms, and the kinds used in milk jugs or bottles is different from those used in nets or ropes.
The polyethylene and the polypropylene, and I'm melting those, and then I'm shredding net nylon and using it as a reinforcement, the fibers, to create a recycled plastic lumber, and then I'm going to sell that locally.
Simpson hopes to get a more sizable EPA grant and use drones to locate plastic debris on beaches. Elsewhere, Radio Canada reports that Goodwood Plastic Products in Nova Scotia has commercialized synthetic lumber made out of derelict fishing gear and other plastics using a nearly $500,000 grant from the government. It's part of a more than $8 million innovative solutions fund that includes fishermen and divers eager to help. Goodwood now employs 10 people and hopes to recycle more than 22 million pounds of plastics annually. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 30. This announcement was issued 10 a.m. August 9th. There will be a 33-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, August 10th to 9 p.m. Wednesday, August 11th in the Iqaluit Bay section of the Afognak District. As previously announced, there will be a 105-hour commercial salmon fishing period from from noon Wednesday, August 11th to 9 p.m. Sunday, August 15th in the following areas: the Northwest Kodiak District, the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District, the Outer Iakulik section of the Southwest Kodiak District, and the Cape Alitak, Humpy Deadman, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District, and the Sitka-Leedic, Two-Headed, and Seven Rivers section of the Eastside Kodiak District. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, August 11th to 9 p.m. Friday, August 13th in the following areas: the Raspberry Strait, northwest of Afognak, Paranosa Bay, northeast of Afognak, Duck Bay, and southeast of Afognak section of the Afognak District, the northeast Kodiak District, except the Buskin River section will remain closed, the inner and outer Ugak Bay sections of the Eastside Kodiak District, and the mainland district, except the inner Kukak Bay section, will remain closed. The Spiriton Bay Special Harvest Area, Telluride Cove, remains open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. Cost recovery fisheries began in the Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area on August 8th. Fishing opportunities in the Duck Bay, Iyuit Bay, inner Katoy Bay, and outer Katoy Bay sections will be dependent on the ability to meet KRAA cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information can be obtained by calling 486-6559. Until further notice, in that portion of the Northwest Kodiak and Southwest Kodiak districts, south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, Chinook salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse angler in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Closed waters are as shown on the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in the Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations. Statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. Recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recordophone at 486-4559.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 9th day of August, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 6:22. It will set again at 10:06. That will give us 15 hours and 45 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 32 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 40, set in 2013, and our record high was 79, set in 1993 and 2019. Currently 55 degrees out at the airport. They are clocking southeast winds to 10 miles per hour there. We're looking for rain today with a high near 56, southeast wind to 10. For tonight, rain before 7, low around 51, east wind to 20, turning to the west after midnight and gusting up to 40 miles per hour tonight. For tomorrow, sunny skies, high near 64, west wind to 10, gusting as high as 20. For Wednesday, they are calling for a 50% chance of rain, cloudy skies on Wednesday with a high near 58. We have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 3:58 p.m., about 4 p.m., that'll be a 7.5-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 9:22 p.m. of 1.8 feet, and another high tide at 3:28 a.m. of 9.4 feet. And tomorrow morning's low tide here on the east side will occur at 10:03 a.m. and be minus 1.2 feet. Over on the west side, and this is Larsen Bay, you have a high tide coming up at 4:19 p.m., about 4:20. That will be a 13.2-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 10:09 this evening of 2.4 feet. Your middle-of-the-night high tide will occur at 4 a.m. and be 14.7 feet, and your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will happen at 10:36 a.m. and be minus 2 feet. Mariners, we do have a gale warning for Kodiak's east side offshore, Marmot Island to Sitkanak for tonight, southwest 20, becoming southeast 30 this afternoon and seas to 9 feet, building to southwest 45 tonight, turning west 30 after midnight, north of Dangerous Cape, southwest 30. Seas 12 feet, building to 17 feet after midnight tonight on our east side. For tomorrow, west 30, becoming southwest 20, seas to 16 feet. Over in the Shelikof, small craft advisory through Tuesday, south wind to 15 right now in the Shelikof, becoming northeast 25 late, seas to 6 feet. For tomorrow, look for southwest 25, seas to 8 feet in the Shelikof. Warm August night is happening next Saturday at the Kodiak Fairgrounds. The admission is 5 cans of food, plus $10 or just $20. For kids under 12, it's 5 cans of food only. Enjoy deluxe hamburgers and hot dogs from the grill. There's a cash bar and beer garden, and classy cars and bikes also featured. Shuttle buses begin at 5:30 from the Harbor Master. Last bus to town is 12:30 a.m. coming back. No dogs, please. No glass, no coolers, and no backpacks. But again, warm August night, and the music starts at 6 p.m. out at the fairgrounds. Shuttle bus starts at 5:30 from the Harbor Master. Also happening on Saturday, the Kodiak 4-H Dog Show. That's happening at the Kodiak Baptist Mission across from Mission Beach. And local sponsors Sutliff's, Harborside Coffee, Glow Skincare, and Barbie Shop are thanked. That's happening at 1 p.m. at the Kodiak Baptist Mission across from Mission Beach.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.